Welcome to the debate. When you look at an antique map of the world, like one of those really sprawling medieval mappamundi things, you aren't actually just looking at geography.
Right, you're usually looking at what? Sea monsters and angels in the corners?
Exactly, yeah. You're looking at theology, history, and mythology, and it's all layered directly on top of the physical coastlines. The map maker wasn't just, trying to show you where the land was. They were trying to make physical space mean something.
Which brings us to today's subject.
It does. Today, we are examining a very modern equivalent of that exact kind of map making. We are diving into a document titled Eons, written by the Anonymous Chronicler, or Dark for short.
And this text takes the empirical, hard scientific history of the universe, literally from the Big Bang all the way to the rise of humanity, and it maps it directly onto the ancient 6-day creation narrative.
Yeah, it attempts to harmonize the raw data of astrophysics, geology, and evolutionary biology with this highly structured, poetic framework. So, our central question today is this: does overlaying ancient mythic structures onto empirical scientific history actually illuminate profound truths about the cosmos, or?
Or does it distort the raw, unguided reality of science by forcing it into a predetermined script?
Right, so I will argue that Epion successfully demonstrates a deep structural alignment where scientific mechanics actually validate the ancient intuition of an ordered progressive cosmos.
And I will argue that while the text is undoubtedly a masterclass in poetic synthesis, it essentially engages in Texas sharpshooter logic. Drawing the target around the bullet holes after they've already been fired. I think by selectively taking random violent phenomena and labeling them as necessary steps, it imposes a false purpose-driven script on what is fundamentally mindless, contingent chaos.
Okay, well, to begin, let me just lay out my perspective on how this text actually operates, because Eons does something frankly remarkable. It translates ancient metaphors into precise scientific milestones without compromising the rigor of the science itself.
I mean, it certainly uses a lot of scientific terminology.
It does, but it's accurate terminology. By taking the timeline of the universe and applying the poetic structure of days or eons, the author proves that poetic frameworks can capture physical mechanics perfectly. It shows that myth and science don't have to be opposing forces, right? They can act as complementary lenses on reality.
I hear you, but the scientific literacy of the author, which is undeniable, by the way, absolutely compromises the philosophy of the science.
How so?
Well, when you take completely undirected evolutionary shifts, or massive celestial collisions, and frame them as deliberate steps in a cosmic forge, you are projecting human intent onto random events. Science relies entirely on the premise that the universe has no inherent script.
But Eons isn't denying the physics.
No, but by suggesting that mass extinctions or planetary impacts were required steps in a grand plan, the text creates this beautiful story that fundamentally sanitizes the brutal, unguided reality of how we actually got here. It literally turns accidents into destiny.
Let's test that idea of sanitization, though, because if you look directly at the astrophysics in the text, take the very first eon, for instance. The text describes the early universe as a burning fog where light was trapped in constant collisions, unable to break free until a specific moment of cooling.
Right. That isn't just poetry. It is a perfect, scientifically rigorous description of the era before recombination. Sure, it is a very accurate description of the plasma state of the early universe, yes. For the first roughly 380,000 years after the Big Bang, the universe was incredibly dense and incredibly hot.
Right, so hot that electrons and protons couldn't even bind together. They were just flying around freely in this chaotic soup of subatomic particles. And because those electrons were free, photons, which are particles of light, couldn't travel through space.
They would just instantly crash into a free electron and scatter.
Exactly. It's like putting your high beams on in a dense wall of physical fog. The light just reflects back at you. The text calls it a burning fog because the universe was quite literally opaque with heat.
And then, obviously, the universe expands, which causes it to cool down.
Yes, it drops below about 3,000 degrees Kelvin. The electrons finally slow down enough to be captured by the protons, and that forms the first atoms of hydrogen and helium. And suddenly, the fog lifts.
The photons have a clear path to travel.
The universe becomes transparent in a single instant, unleashing the cosmic microwave background radiation. Now, Eons takes that highly complex mechanical phase transition, the exact moment photons decoupled from matter, and frames it as the literal realization of let there be light. The physical mechanism actually validates the metaphor.
Okay, look, the mechanism validates the visual imagery. Sure, I'll give you that. But framing it as let there be light strongly implies a speaker. It implies a command.
I think it just implies an awakening.
No, it implies that the universe was waiting in the dark until a switch was flipped. For a specific purpose, recombination wasn't a command. It was a thermodynamic inevitability. Heat dissipates, atoms form, light travels. That's just physics.
But
when you attach a narrative of intentionality to basic thermodynamics, you start sliding down a very slippery slope where every physical reaction is treated as a miracle rather than a mere mechanism.
I don't think the narrative is claiming the thermodynamics is magic, though. It's recognizing that the mechanism itself is miraculous in its result. And we see this even more clearly when the text handles the physical origins of our planet.
You mean the third eon stuff?
Yes. In the third eon, Eons redefines the ancient concept of the Rakia, the firmament. In ancient mythology, the firmament was a literal solid dome in the sky holding back the waters of space. But this text grounds the firmament in hard geology. It talks about water trapped in crystals of ringwoodite deep in the Earth's mantle, eventually released by heat.
Okay, wait, I'm going to stop you right there, because I want to make sure I understand the physical mechanism you're praising so highly here. I am picturing like a hollow geode splashing around with liquid deep underground. How does a crystal hold an ocean's worth of water?
That's a great question, and I honestly think it speaks to the text's scientific depth. It's not liquid water splashing around in some subterranean cavern.
Okay.
Ringwoodite is a mineral found in the Earth's transition zone, which is about 400 to 600 kilometers below the surface. Under that extreme pressure, the molecular structure of this silicate rock actually acts like a sponge, trapping hydroxide ions, so oxygen and hydrogen atoms. The water is chemically locked inside the solid rock.
Ah, I see.
Right? The text notes that this vast, hidden ocean was eventually driven to the surface by extreme volcanic heat and tectonic activity, forming the oceans we know today.
Along with cyanobacteria breathing out oxygen to form the ozone layer, which the text also mentions.
Right. But more than that, the text really leans into the violence of the planet's formation. It actively compares the late heavy bombardment to a blacksmith's forge.
A blacksmith's forge?
Yes, it embraces the massive asteroid strikes that form the moon and reshape the Earth's crust, recontextualizing them as creative violence. It doesn't hide the chaos. It finds the order within it.
Creative violence.
Think of a sculptor working with raw stone. To the stone, the strikes of the chisel are violent. They're fracturing and they're completely destructive. But the ultimate result of those strikes is form, structure, and definition. The text's framing of creative violence simply gives us a vocabulary to understand the remarkable result.
Which is?
We have a planet shielded by an ozone layer. We have a moon that stabilizes our axial tilt, which, as you know, prevents wild climate swings and makes complex life possible.
Well, your sculptor analogy actually perfectly illustrates the massive flaw in this entire framework. A sculptor has a conscious intention. A sculptor knows exactly what they're trying to make before the chisel ever even hits the stone. The universe does not.
Does it need to have conscious intent to produce a functional result?
Yes, if you're going to use words like forge. Calling the late heavy bombardment an essential part of the world's making projects human intent onto what were simply massive, completely random space rocks crashing into each other due to gravity.
But the result of those crashes literally built the foundation for life.
That doesn't mean it was planned. The moon wasn't formed to order time or be a faithful companion to Earth, as the text poetically suggests. It is simply the remnant of a catastrophic, completely accidental impact between the early Earth and a Mars-sized body called Theia.
It still orders our tides and time, though.
Sure, but the ozone layer wasn't placed there as a protective veil to guard the life that was yet to come. It is a biochemical byproduct of cyanobacteria respiration. It just happened. And because it happened, certain types of life could survive on the surface. Eons entirely reverses the arrow of causality.
Reverses it how?
It makes it sound like the Earth was being prepared for us, rather than life simply adapting to whatever random environment happened to exist at the time. It turns a cosmic accident into a deliberate forging process.
Okay, well, if we accept that the physical Earth was shaped by violent phenomena, the real test of this narrative framework is how it handles biological violence, specifically mass extinctions.
I was wondering when we'd get to the dinosaurs.
Exactly. Because if the universe is just a sequence of blind accidents, as you say, then the death of the dinosaurs is the ultimate proof of your contingency argument. Let's look at how Dark handles the transition into the Cenozoic era.
You mean the asteroid impact at Chicxulub?
Yes. In the 5th and 6th eons, the text looks at the rise and fall of the terrible lizards, and it doesn't shy away from the reality of extinction. It explicitly states that the Leviathan and Behemoth fell not through wickedness, but because their time had come.
Which is quite a pivot.
It's a massive departure from ancient myths. Those myths almost always frame global catastrophes, like floods or fires, as divine punishment for moral failings. Here, extinction is stripped of moral judgment entirely. It is just a mechanism of the universe.
A mechanism that involved a giant rock of fire.
Yes, the massive reptiles fall, which clears the ecological niches so that small, adaptable mammals hiding in the crevices can survive, radiate, and eventually inherit the Earth. The text frames extinction not as a failure, but as life learning that letting go is also part of being.
Letting go is also part of being. I mean, it is incredibly poetic, I will give you that. But it severely sanitizes the brutal randomness of that meteor impact.
Sanitizes it? It acknowledges they died.
Framing the fiery, agonizing death of billions of creatures as simply their time had come implies a preordained script. It suggests that the dinosaurs needed to exit the stage so that mammals could take over. It completely ignores the scientific reality that this event was entirely contingent.
Contingent in what way, though? The asteroid hit. The climate changed. The dinosaurs couldn't adapt. The mammals could. That is just natural selection in action.
The contingency lies in the exact physics of the impact itself. If that asteroid misses the Earth by a fraction of a degree, or even just arrives a few hours later, it hits the deep waters of the Pacific Ocean instead of the shallow sulfur-rich carbonate rocks of the Yucatan Peninsula.
Okay, but it didn't.
But if it hits deep water, you get massive tsunamis, sure. But you do not get the global vaporization of rock that choked the atmosphere with sulfur and triggered a years-long global winter. The dinosaurs survived for 165 million years. They didn't just let go.
I'm not saying they willfully gave up.
They were eradicated by a random rock of fire. If the Earth is rotated just slightly differently on that Tuesday 66 million years ago, the dinosaurs likely don't go extinct, mammals remain completely marginalized in the underbrush, and we are certainly not having this debate today.
That is a fair point about the physics. But consider where the ashes of that rock of fire actually ended up. The vaporized rock, the soot, the organic material that choked the atmosphere, it eventually settled, right? It became incorporated into the geological strata.
The KP boundary, yeah.
Exactly. That layer of destruction physically degraded into the very soil that modern mammals and eventually human agriculture depend on today. The chaos quite literally fertilized the survival of the next era.
That's a stretch.
Is it? If evolution is indeed a chain of sequential, dependent events, why can't the metaphor of letting go simply be a poetic but highly accurate reflection of ecological succession? Old dominant forms must be cleared out for new forms to diversify. The text uses the language of poetry to describe the macro-scale reality of the entire biological web.
It describes the outcome, sure, but it fundamentally alters the tone of the reality. Letting go implies a peaceful transition. Evolution doesn't have narrative arcs. It has survival and reproduction, full stop.
But we can...
When the text says they perished because their time had come,
it introduces a concept of destiny that simply does not exist in biology. Stripping away the randomness softens the absolute indifference of the universe to the suffering and extinction of its creatures.
You argue that it softens the indifference, but I argue that it translates that indifference into a framework humans can actually process. Which honestly leads us to the ultimate test of this progression narrative, the text's final eon and the arrival of humanity itself.
Ah, yes, the grand culmination of the script.
But look closely at how Dark actually defines that culmination. The text completely redefines what it means to be made in the image and likeness of God. It abandons the traditional idea of physical dominion or supremacy over nature.
True. It goes a different route.
It defines humanity entirely through evolutionary milestones. It highlights the moment we walked upright, which freed our hands from locomotion, allowing us to manipulate tools. It points to the subsequent cognitive leaps, the ability to remember the past, to name our surroundings, to look ahead into the future.
Right.
It defines our role not as conquerors, but as the moment the universe began to know itself through human eyes.
And see, that exact phrase, the universe began to know itself through human eyes, is the ultimate anthropocentric trap.
Why is it a trap to acknowledge our own unique capacity for observation?
Because by positioning humans as the grand finale of the sixth eon, the singular conscious awakening of the cosmos, the text separates humanity from the rest of the biological web. It treats us as an end goal, the reason the whole forge was fired up in the first place, rather than just another branch on the tree of life.
I think it just highlights what makes us distinct.
We are highly adapted primates with highly developed brains. We are not the climax of some cosmic play. Framing us as the universe's way of knowing itself flatters us. It pretends the previous 13.8 billion years were just a prologue for our arrival.
But is it truly a bias to point that out, or is it just an objective, empirical recognition of human cognitive uniqueness? We are the species that builds the telescopes. We are the species that uncovered the cosmic microwave background radiation and that burning fog we talked about.
Yes, because of our brain casing.
We are the species drilling into the Earth's mantle to understand the silicate structures of ringwoodite. To deny that the emergence of human consciousness represents a radical, unprecedented shift in the universe's history is to ignore the very scientific reality that the text is highlighting.
Look, our cognitive complexity is a remarkable evolutionary adaptation. Certainly, the ability to reflect, to name things, to build those telescopes, it's incredibly complex. But it is an adaptation driven by the exact same mindless environmental pressures that gave the dinosaurs their massive size or the birds their feathers.
But the text directly addresses that. It says birds rose from the lineage of great reptiles, as if the earth itself have learned to ascend.
And that is exactly my problem. Biology isn't striving upward. It's just adapting outward to fill empty niches. The text applies this progressive, upward-striving motive to basic biology.
It's a metaphor for flight.
But a bird's wing isn't the earth trying to touch the sky. It's a mutation that provided an advantage in escaping predators or catching insects. By putting humans at the pinnacle of this false upward trajectory, Eons demands that we look at the random, contingent history of reality and see a deliberate plan.
I just don't believe acknowledging consciousness as a distinct threshold requires a deliberate plan. I think it simply requires acknowledging reality. Consciousness is fundamentally different from a physical adaptation like feathers or size.
How so? They both aid survival.
Feathers allow a creature to navigate the physical atmosphere. Consciousness allows a creature to navigate time, to construct meaning, to mathematically map the cosmos itself. The text specifically states humanity was not the strongest or swiftest. It elevates us based purely on our capacity for reflection.
Which is a biological function.
Yes. But when atoms of hydrogen and helium forged in the heart of stars eventually organize themselves into a biological brain capable of contemplating those very stars, a profound threshold has been crossed. The universe goes from an object to a subject.
A threshold into a new type of biological complexity has been crossed. Yes, I agree with that. But a threshold into cosmic purpose has not. And that is my core issue with Eons.
The purpose part.
Exactly. The way it describes stars as furnaces of fusion where matter learned to turn itself into light, that is genuinely beautiful, evocative writing, but it demands that we view the universe as an ordered progression from chaos to consciousness. It forces the raw, incredible data of existence into a storybook.
Well, to summarize my position on this, I believe Aeons provides a vital, sophisticated bridge between the empirical and the existential. It takes the hard scientific realities, the exact mechanisms of photon decoupling, the immense pressure trapping water in mantle rock, the ecological succession following a meteor strike, and uses them to enrich our deep need for meaning.
It certainly enriches the narrative.
It proves that facts and poetry do not have to be at war. They can elevate one another, providing us a framework to understand our place in a universe that is both scientifically intelligible and profoundly mysterious.
And to summarize my view, I fully acknowledge that the prose is undeniably beautiful, and it's deeply literate in the sciences. But forcing the raw facts of astrophysics and biology into the structured days of a myth risks obscuring the true undirected wonder of reality.
The wonder of randomness.
Yes, a cosmos that operates on blind, contingent chaos, where the angle of a random asteroid strike can change the entire trajectory of life, doesn't need to be a deliberate forge to be spectacular. In fact, I'd say its lack of intentionality, its sheer randomness, might be exactly what makes our conscious existence so incredibly rare and precious.
Well, I think we can both agree that the source text demonstrates a remarkably deep, accurate grasp of scientific mechanisms. The author Dark hasn't just skimmed a textbook. They really understand the nuanced physics of the early universe, planetary formation, and evolutionary biology.
Oh, without a doubt. And they have transformed those mechanisms into striking literature. The imagery of the firmament being struck like hot iron, or the dinosaurs exploring life's limits through unbridled physical form, it is a very compelling way to visualize natural history.
It really is. So, returning to that ancient map we discussed at the very beginning, when you layer the narrative of meaning over the raw terrain of science, you create something new. Something that asks us to look at the coastlines of reality in a completely different way.
A different perspective on the same territory.
Exactly. We'll leave it to you to ponder whether overlaying these ancient narrative frameworks onto scientific history illuminates our place in the cosmos or limits our understanding of its raw, unguided reality. The universe is a vast territory, and there is always more to explore in how we choose to map it.